Welcome to Podnos, Computer Repair Podcast, episode number 225, Cash Flow Tips. I'm your host, Jeff Hallisch. This is our live call-in show for Computer Repair Techs. We answer your questions on running and operating your computer repair business. The call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. The Computer Repair Podcast is brought to you by Ninja, the simple-to-use remote monitoring and management solution. Try it free at info.ninjamsp.com/podnuts. Let me introduce the co-host. We have Paco LeBron from Prodigy Techs. How you doing, Paco?
Better than I deserve.
All right. And we also have joining us today, Chris Carruthers from the Remote Support Tech Team. How you doing, Chris?
I'm styling, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. And last but not least, we have John Dubinsky from the Maven Group. How you doing, John?
I'm ready to descend into the madness, Jeff.
And that is what we do here. Shortly, we should have a Brad Torrey from TTCS Computer Services joining in the conversation. But right now, let's go ahead and share a tip or story. And Chris, why don't you go ahead and take it this week and share a tip or story with us that we could learn from?
Sure. Well, I know we've talked about it before, but I'm going to talk about it again. Insist on doing a diagnostic on every single computer. Mm. Once again, wind up running into a customer who says, I need a virus removal. I need a virus removal. Take my credit card. You're going to do a virus removal. I said, no. Let's test the hard drive. Let's test the hard drive. They refused to bring it in. So, you know, remote in, Crystal Disk Info. And bam, look at that. Your hard drive's failing. You're going to have to bring it in so that we can replace the hard drive. Right. So I know that we kept on talking about it, but if you don't do that hardware test, you're just going to wind up doing a whole bunch of work on a computer that's still not going to work right.
Now, Chris, that brings up a good point. Now, you use Crystal Disk Info. Is there any other software that you use remotely that will work to let you know the state of the hard drive?
Remotely? Well, yeah. I mean, so there's the...
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, it's fine. It just really depends on the situation, right? I know you hate it depends, but it's true. Because Crystal Disk Info is really small, so it's easy to get onto a system that's running slowly. Okay. If the system is running properly, then the Repair Tech Solutions tech suite has hardware diagnostics built into it as one of the automated tools. So, running that will give you all the smart data as well. But really my go-to is Tech USB. I want to have that computer so that I can, do a proper offline scan. So anything that you do inside Windows, I don't really 100% trust.
Yeah, it's a good baseline. It gets you started and lets you know if you start seeing some errors and Crystal Disk shows you that, maybe you go in and you do a short test or a long test while it's offline. That probably is the best solution, or in a pre-boot environment, which is still technically offline. Basically the best way to do it. But, I've seen from both sides where I'm still getting some weird issues, not sure why. And it's usually I can run a short test. I can run Crystal Disk Info. Everything passes. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, I go and do a long test and it fails.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow. Yeah. So
it's never going to be perfect, but right. It is nice when you're running something like Crystal Disk Info. Don't accidentally download the Shinzuku edition or whatever it's called. I did that once. My customer was a little weirded out that they suddenly had anime popping up on their computer. It's nice to have this big yellow or big red caution or failing icon just to say, like, look, like it's very, very obvious there's something wrong here.
Right. That's good. Very good. All right. And John, why don't you go ahead and share a tip or story with us?
I got two quick ones. System came in with a failing hard drive, so I was able to do a clone, no problem. But after I cloned, I still could not get boot. So I stuck the old hard drive back in, and I ran a little program called HDD, or Hard Disk Drive Regenerator. That puppy, system booted right up, made a new clone, saved me some time. So I'll put a link for that in. It's a nice little program.
Is that a free program?
The other problem I had is that it is not free.
Okay. That's a paid for program.
Yes. For many years. $90.
Mm-hmm. Well worth it.
The time it just saved me, I paid for that in a heartbeat.
That's a $90 technician license, or is that a per use license?
There's only one license to buy.
Nice.
Very cool. Good.
1 year minor updates you get for that. You get a discount on major upgrades, 30-day money back guaranteed, unlimited license period.
Good. Awesome.
And I would get, I'll put the link, but I can't say his name. He's obviously Russian with the name like he has, Dimitri. Sorry, Dimitri, I can't say your last name, even though I'm Polish. Okay, so the next issue I had was a Windows Update issue. I had a PC that would just not run Windows Update, and I threw a bunch of utilities at it, the Windows repair tools, the stuff from AskVG, a bunch of stuff, and nothing was doing it. So I was digging and digging and digging around. So finally, I went to the Windows System 32 folder and looked at the WAU, the DLL files, all the files associated with Windows Update. And I found that they all had a little nice little padlock on them, which can mean a couple of things. But in this instance, it meant that the files were marked private for a particular Windows profile or a Windows user. All right. So I tried to just unlock those. I could not, no matter what. When I right-clicked on the file, even though I was logged in as an admin, it did not give me an option to do anything with user rights on those files. So basically what I did, I just copied those three files from a different Windows 7 machine, blew those files away, replaced the files, and then I was back in business. So, and I'll put some links into the show notes.
Nice. Very nice fix. All right.
So,
cool. All right. And Mr. Paco LeBron, what do you got for us?
A story and a tip.
All right.
So I will start with the story. So the story goes similar to what John was mentioning as far as a bad hard drive, but I had a system that had bad memory. Now, the interesting part about this whole thing was, yes, indeed. But essentially, there what was going on was a client emailed us letting us know that he was using his system. It kept BSODing on his machine. So, and that's what we've been advertising as far as our business, that we're starting to focus that as our niche. We do all BSODs, blue screens, can't boot, whatever. So I said, it could be a hardware issue. Bring it in. We'll see what's going on. Well, I ran Tech USB on the machine because it sounded like it was a hardware issue, because he also tried to reinstall the operating system himself when he tried to create his own media. Now, when he reinstalled with his own media, it came up with the cannot boot in Windows. So he just had bad media altogether, along with the hardware issue. I ran Tech USB. Everything passed under a full diagnostic. But something told me that the fact that he reinstalled the operating system, I ran Tech USB, it's still flagged. Something told me it wasn't right. So I figured the hard drive might be okay because it ran the long hardware block test. Let me run mem test on Tech USB because they have that available for you and see what's going on. Ran it, flagged all kinds of red blocks on what was going on. Now, the thing about his ThinkPad was it was a W30 and had four slots of memory. So, yeah, it took me a couple minutes to try and figure out, or a couple times to figure out what memory chip was bad. Put that in there, ran my Lenovo Windows 7 system that I had, media, activated it, everything was good to go. So the point of the story is essentially you're going to know your process more than what a system may tell you. So sometimes you have to trust your gut. So in this case where Tech USB flagged everything successful, in my history, I know that if he reinstalled it and it's still BSOD'd on him, it's a hardware issue. So it's got to be memory. It's got to be hard drive. So I went to another tool and that's what ended up going from there. So that's my story. Tip is for local marketing. What I have been doing is focusing on Twitter and talking to a lot of the condominium towers that are in the area. So essentially what's going on is I've been getting a lot of residents from several particular addresses. And when I pulled up the addresses, I found out that these are the condominium towers that are nearby my office. There's three main ones that are around there. So I was trying to figure out a clever way of getting a hold of the property management without sending a blind email that would just look as spam. So I decided to just do an at reply publicly to their handles. And I actually received two out of the three of them to reply back, letting me know, email this person, here's the contact, here's the phone number. We'd love to be able to do something with you. And essentially, I got something working up with them.
Oh, very good. Now, let me go back to the memory test. When you figured out that there was a bad module, and sure, generally it's one. So do you pull all the modules out and just stick one in at a time to test it? Or what's your process for doing that?
So essentially, I start pulling one at a time.
Okay.
So I will pull one, run it. If it still flags, pull another one, run it, flags. And I kind of go from that way. Now, eventually, if the thing goes out, then I know that whatever I just pulled out, I just got to make sure I keep track of the chips. And especially if they're all the same brand, make sure that I don't mix them up. But essentially, I pull one at a time to determine if the flags are still happening. And if it stops, then I know that chip. And then I re-put in the other ones that I pulled, run it one final time to ensure that that was the chip, that that module that was bad, and go from there.
Okay. And the reason I was asking is because everybody does it a little differently. Now, for me, I've always pulled all the chips. Mm-hmm. I'll put one in at a time, turn it on, and usually right away you'll know if you've got the one bad chip in there, it'll fail out. And then I'll do the same thing. I'll put whatever the other three chips are back into those slots and run it. And usually it's a pretty fast way to go that way. But yeah, you can do it either way. I was just curious.
Yeah, I pull them the same way too. And I actually change the order once I figure out what's the bad one, because I want to determine if it's not a bad slot either, right?
Right, exactly. So good point. All right. And Brad Torrey from TTCS Computer Services has joined us. So Brad, you are in the middle of it. And do you have a tip or story for us this week?
Hey, yeah. Made it just in the nick of time. I've got a couple, two little things that I noted down here. The first being, Anthony and I have been trying to figure out how to get more regular business, like Excel, Word, email type people that, you know, employees, getting them on a better computer, specifically one of his. But, and he can't build a system that he'll stand behind for less than retailing around $1,000.
Right.
So that's with a proper power supply and an SSD and something that actually will work, you know, and perform for a long amount of time. I've mentioned it to people and they're like, whoa, I can get a computer for $300. That's in their head. It's not true. They'll end up spending $600 or $700 for the computer eventually.
Yep.
But their brain is thinking $300. So I had a client come up, need a computer, and actually they needed it for a really, really basic stuff. And not frequent. It's for restaurant managers. They occasionally come in and use this computer to like print something or look something up on the web. So it really doesn't need like the standards. This computer could be a $300 computer and actually work just fine. But I didn't want to sell, like have them just go out and grab a $300 Dell when I knew that their CFO was struggling with her computer and didn't know it. Like, it's not an old computer. It was a Dell Optiplex. Long story short, she doesn't know that this computer's dog slow and she's losing her mind because she's having to work with this computer and she doesn't know because she's never experienced anything better.
Right.
So Anthony happened to have, we'd been working on like, okay, this is going to be the model of computer that we're going to try to have a regular workstation run on. He had all the parts and I'm like, dude, can you throw a demo together in like an hour? I'm going to go, or, you know, 2 hours, just something that'll work. I'm going to go clone her hard drive to it and basically set it up as her computer and leave it in place for her. And when she comes in on Monday morning, and I told her I was doing this, this wasn't a surprise, but I'm like, you have to just work with this computer for a couple of days. And then if you don't want it, because I'm going to tell you up front what it costs. If you think it's worthwhile, you can keep it. You know, well, actually, Anthony would replace it with new parts, but you know, essentially she gets to keep this computer. And if not, no problem. We'll go get you the Dell that you want. Monday morning comes around. There were a couple little issues. Windows 10 decided, we didn't actually end up cloning the drive. I just transferred her profile over and stuff.
Okay.
So now Windows 10's doing some background updates, of course, even though we've tried to get it up to date ahead of time. So there was some funky stuff. But as soon as that was all handled, within 5 minutes, I was working on something else in her office. She's like, yeah, this is fast. We're keeping this computer for sure. Like, no. And this is a company that doesn't love to spend money. Like, you got to convince them to spend money. They will, but they need to feel that they justify the expense. No time, like no hesitation. So I've heard a lot of techs talk about carrying, if they're doing residential work or even repairs, carry a stick of RAM. It's a really easy, quick sell. Like, oh, I'm going to put this RAM in your system and you can see how much faster it is. This is like, that times, you know, 1,000. Just so this is our new thing. We're gonna make sure that we demo these computers because people just don't know. They don't know what they don't know. And as soon as you show them what their world could be like, I have a feeling they will probably never buy a crappy Dell again. Like they'll probably just do the hand-me-down thing.
Right.
You know, as soon as all the people that are in the top positions have one of these systems, then maybe the oldest of Anthony's systems will get handed down to the next one and they'll just get a new one and always be. So anyway, it was a win. I didn't think I could sell them, but I really didn't think I could sell them $1,000 computer.
Nice. Now,
I did.
If you guys thought about maybe making different types of workstations or, you know, a workstation, maybe a gaming system, and actually putting the parts on a list and going, hey, here's what we're going to get you, blah, blah, blah. Or does that just seem like, would people look at that and just go, ah, it's still a lot of money for that same type of thing? Because when you compare the Dell $300 computer to a home-built computer, the components are way different. And a lot of times that may not mean something to a lot of people depending on what types of things they're doing. But let's face it, if you're using QuickBooks or any of these other pieces of software, man, if you've got a slow system, you can definitely feel it just doing simple things like accounting. And here's the thing, like you said, most people don't know it. I get people's computers that it's so dog slow that I look at it and go, how long have you been dealing with it like this? Oh, it's been like that for like 6 months. And you're just now bringing this to me. Are you kidding? But see, for them, a lot of people, it's normal to wake up in the morning, go down, push the button, the power button on their computer, go make a pot of coffee, drink a cup of coffee, go back down to their computer and get on it. And they think that is normal.
So that's my normal routine when I'm working on some people's computers.
Exactly. Oh, so anyways.
Now, Anthony
has a... Most business owners don't realize the cost of an ongoing cost of a PC. What's the average? 30 minutes per employee per week, just troubleshooting small problems. You know, you look at all the cost justifications for a second monitor, or that 80% of the cost of purchasing a PC is after the purchase of a PC. So,
yep.
You get what you pay for. That's
and,
for sure.
And like, we have a friend, you know, kind of another guy that I know locally who sells and services printers and toner. And he sells his printers at retail. So if you go on Amazon, you can probably undercut him by like $40 or whatever for the same thing. And I'm like, well, yes, but printers break. One of the reasons that I don't like them is that they break. You know, printers suck. Don't go paperless. But I'm like, buy it from him, because if there's a warranty issue, he will come to you and handle it, you know, whereas if you buy it from anywhere else, you're going to have to deal with that. And you're probably gonna have to ship it out. Or, you know, at that point, you're probably just going to choose to buy a new one.
Right.
So, you know, if you like just dropping $500 every time you have a spring go bad on your printer, then, you know, go for it. But otherwise, just get it from the local guy and spend a couple extra bucks. But he's now there to service you.
Right.
And your business continuity is better in that case. And it doesn't really cost you that much more.
I've said this for a long time, but service, I believe, in the service industry, no pun intended, is going to win long term. Now, a lot of people don't, for whatever reason, maybe some people don't believe that, I don't know, but here's the thing. Anytime that I can get just a little bit above average service from a service company for whatever, I will go back to that company time and time again, no matter what it costs. I at that point, because they're taking care of me and my needs, I don't even care about the cost. It's like, hey, they do a good job. I know it's going to get done and I'm good with that. But sometimes you got to show the customer that that's what we're doing. We're there for their best interest. We're not there to gouge them. We're not there to just take their money for taking their money's sake. We're there to provide them a service that's going to benefit them long term. And that's what we do. So, all right. Was that it, Brad? Did you have another one, or was that just the one story there?
I'm working on a project using PC6 for a surveillance camera wall. But I haven't really set it up yet. But it's kind of it's just an interesting note. I went on a long time on the last one, so we'll kind of.
That's all right. Go ahead. You guys got some more information? Floor's yours.
No, we just our AV guy doesn't, you know, he's starting to get over his head a little bit at this one company. They have an AV guy that does like their surveillance cameras and their TVs and stuff. And the world is changing around him. They asked him to set up like Command Central. So this one office wants to be monitoring all these other locations. So they had five TVs put up, but they sort of started this project and they were talking to him about it because he does the cameras. And then he came to me and he's like, I have no idea how to make this happen. Like, I don't know how to get these cameras to view on these TVs. They're like, okay, well, we'll figure it out, you know? And you know, like with camera systems, they work pretty well with an app. And usually viewing them in a browser is tricky because the browsers are now, you know, kind of tightening down on security on plugins.
Right.
So like if a plugin isn't properly signed and kept up to date, then the browser won't let it run and that sort of thing. And I've had to find like workarounds to get Chrome to install. But now the Chrome's taken those workarounds out of the back end, so you can't do it anymore. So anyway, I'm like, really a PC is better. You're not going to be able to do it on a, like a smart TV. It's not going to happen. So if you want these on TVs, you need to hook them up to a computer. So we're getting, we bought five, where is it? The Azul little, this is the Quantum Access. And it's just one of those little HDMI. It's a little bit bigger than a Chromecast.
Okay.
About $100. And they're actually, because of the storage is SSD, they're even though they're a little underpowered and don't have a lot of memory, they're pretty snappy. They're nice. I wouldn't use it like on a daily basis myself, but for what this is going to be, they've been perfect. I've been testing it out on my TV. And so we're going to have, it's going to be rad. It's going to be like, you know, some Command Central, and there's each TV is going to have four cameras on it, and they're going to add more. So like this whole room's just going to be circled by surveillance cameras. It's going to probably scare employees when they walk in there.
Isn't that
the first time that someone's used the word rad on this show?
Probably.
That can't be. I'm from California. I use the word way too much.
Isn't it amazing though, that for $100, you can basically get a PC on a stick that you're able to put into a TV to get a signal from another device to show up on that TV.
It's crazy.
It is. It's the times we live in. Man.
Hey, Brad, is that the one with the LAN or without the LAN?
You know, I bought one of each to okay. test them out. They're identical except for the LAN port.
Gotcha.
And that area, it's going to be a little tricky to run cable to those locations. So I think we're just going to stick with the Wi-Fi ones. Gotcha. But
well, definitely.
I think just having a LAN port on that makes it go from $100 to like $130.
Okay.
So,
well, let us know how that works, because I'm always interested in things that are Wi-Fi, how well they work. In some instances, Wi-Fi can work perfectly fine, especially when we're talking about a signal, a video signal, just that you're using to monitor. So that'd be interesting. All right, let's go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll go into our main topic. Our show today is brought to you by Ninja, the remote monitoring and management solution to help you become more efficient, more productive, and more profitable. With Ninja, you can have a faster fixed response time and offer preventative maintenance to your customers. Ninja understands what you need to run your business, which is why their RMM solution is integrated with tools that you use every day. Ninja provides competitive pricing, patch management, antivirus, email, and SMS alerting. You can be up and running quickly with minimum training time. You have TeamViewer integration for that remote support. It's one solution for managed and non-managed clients. So that means you can use it inside of Ninja and outside for your client base, which is awesome. It has network visibility inside the RMM, so you can see what is going on a particular network. You have easy-to-read dashboards, which is something I really enjoy because I'm a simple guy. I like to see the information in front of my face. So they do that. Ninja is always adding new features, like a powerful new device search where you can create custom queries and export the list to show your customers. And a new executive style report showing important system metrics such as health score, software added or removed, hardware changes, and TeamViewer connections. And I just have to say, they have been doing some fantastic updating, and there's a lot of information that you can get to even quicker than I could when I first got started with them. So I'm really liking a lot of the new features that they are rolling out. It's very nice. So Ninja is offering Podnuts a free 30-day trial, and when you decide to buy, a 10% discount. To take advantage of this offer, go to info.ninjamsp.com/podnuts. All right, on to our main topic. How do we keep the cash flowing? Now, this was brought up by none other than Brad Torrey himself. So, Brad, I'm going to have you kick off, and this might be the first time in history that a co-host is actually going to talk more than the host. So go ahead and let us know what you were thinking about in cash flow tips, because you brought this up a couple weeks ago, and it was something that you were working on in your business.
Yeah, it's definitely, well, whether you like it or not, it's going to be the something you deal with every day. If you aren't managing your cash flow, it's going to cause a lot of problems. And it's been just something that I've been working through for years, actually. And then I don't know why it came to mind that I wanted to talk about it the other day. But basically, I found in my business that when I have cash on hand, I'm able to get things done more efficiently and faster, usually. And which becomes a self-perpetuating machine. Like, I'm able to complete projects faster, get the billing done faster, get things done faster, then more money comes in faster, and then I have more cash flow to continue that on. And then that's all great until, you know, something, a hiccup happens, and then, you know, the system crashes for a minute, and then I have to kind of come back around again. But yeah, so, and then when you don't, when you're tight on cash, which I've definitely have experienced, everything takes longer. If a project requires some kind of parts or hardware or something, and you don't have the cash on hand to do that, you got to figure out how to maybe borrow from the next project that got paid or something to pay for that. And then, you know, you got to do all this tricky stuff, and it usually delays things and slows it down. And you've got to build that momentum back up again and get back on your feet. So, I've been just, you know, little things that I found to kind of improve my cash flow, and not even so much from an accounting standpoint. I mean, you'd think that would be where you would tackle it, but it's really more from an efficiency standpoint. I take a small portion of profits, and allocate to slowly building up like inventory, network cables and, screws and just all kinds of things that I've found are actually, I don't stock parts myself because of, you know, it doesn't really help me in what I do very often. I don't stock things that are, can expire, basically, like RAM can, you know, and it's not universal. I try to, if I inventory something, it's probably because it's fairly universally useful. But, you know, you can decide what kind of things that you need to have on hand. But if you show up at a job, especially if you go on site a lot, and you happen to have that cable, that adapter, that thing that you can, that would have held you up, that saves you a trip, you get that job done. And when that job's done, you bill for it. So, those kind of efficiencies have helped. And then, I try to keep, you know, a minimal cash on hand just for, hey, this tax bill came up or something, so that that doesn't end up really just kicking you in the pants that day. You're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that expense. And, the other thing that having a little cash war chest on hand helps with is, if someone's got a big project that they come to you for and they pay for it up front, or they at least put a deposit down for the parts, but you've got to wait for the cash to clear in the bank. A check or a credit card takes days to process. If you have cash on hand and you know that you can trust this person, this business, you've worked with them before or something, then you can already get that order going and get started on that project without having to wait for the you know, the banking to happen. So, those are sort of some of my thoughts. The other thing I think that was really important, that I started doing a couple years ago is I have an Excel sheet, and I've converted it to a Google Doc, but, it is my profit calculator. So I put in my costs. I have formulas for how the markup works. And then I have areas for labor, and then I have a summary page, and it tells me if I'm making enough money on this project or if I bid it wrong, before I actually get it to the customer. So, if you don't know what your profit margin is, if you're making money on stuff, how do you know where to price it? So that was
That was good.
That's it.
No, that's good. So, John, since you're the senior computer guy here.
Inexperience, not age.
Ouch.
Man. But John, what types of things, obviously you started this business from a, where a lot of us have started from a just starting out, and you've gotten to where you're at now. And talk about some of the things that you do for cash flow in order to keep, make sure that you've got money to do what it is you need to do.
Big topic. So let's start at the beginning. Way at the beginning, you know, everything I would say goes back to that little saying that says cash is king. So back when I started my company and I didn't even own a computer when I was doing this, all I had was my little Samsung fax machine. You know, you're really keeping an eye on cash flow. And then the larger and more involved you get with your clients, cash is always still king, but there's a couple of things you need to keep up with. One is structuring your payments. And what I mean by that is the payments from your customers. So you should be setting up terms. And if you do project work, a great example might be is customers, and I think Bradford mentioned this, customers pay for hardware up front, so you don't have to carry that outlay and services on job completion or something to that. So that you have, what you're doing is you're managing when you know your cash is going to arrive. Because on the back end, you have to be able to keep up with your debt. So if you're going to borrow money, whether that is a loan from a bank or use your credit cards or use your on-hand cash to fund either projects or your reoccurring expenses, then you know you need to manage the cost of that cash. So if you're going to carry a credit card and you miss a payment, that's an ugly, I don't even know what a credit card, what is it, 15, 17, 20%? I mean, that's an ugly percentage to pay, depending on the margins on the job that you're doing. So as Bradford said, you know, you have to keep up with the money that you're going to outlay against on projects versus the money that you need to cover your expenses. And what do they call it? A rainy day fund. You should always have a personal rainy day fund, but I would suggest you should have a business rainy day fund as well. So in a nutshell, you know, that's your cash flow. But the more important question is, how do you do that? Besides structuring your payments from your clients, you want to sort of have predictable cash flow that's coming in my opinion. Two ways to do that. We've covered both of these in other shows are one, set up retainers, being an MSP or whatever the acronym is, you know, so you have regular monthly income of some sort, either from services or your billing. Or two, if you're quote unquote a break fix client, work with your clients to have planned services, meaning, Jeff, you can remind me, I can't remember who he is. He's in a smaller community, but he schedules computer cleaning every quarter. He was on a daily. I can't remember his name, but he had this nailed down.
Yeah.
Mark Cobb.
He had this nailed down where he had a plan. He went to his quarterly appointment, already set the next quarterly appointment with the client before he even left, you know, had some of his remote work already pre-scheduled. So a lot of what I try to do to control my cash flow, even though everything I do is billed monthly, everything I do is on retainer, I still also cash flow based on replacement of equipment. So I try to keep track of when equipment needs replaced, and I already pre-plan that with the client. So it gets pre-approved. We replace those PCs every 3 years, or we have a schedule to do one a month, or they know that the wireless access points are ancient and we need to replace them, or whatever that might be. Try to get something on a recurring and book that, schedule that, book it as income. So you know that it's coming. You already know that you have 20 billable hours next month because it's already on your calendar. So that is my plan for doing it. Since I'm a retainer provider, I also try to plan my hardware upgrades as well.
That's good. Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. All right. Paco, why don't you go ahead and tell us what cash flow tips mean, or what cash flow tips you have, or what it means to you?
Rob a bank. No. So basically, don't do that for anybody who's trying. But I've done a couple things a little bit unique for my stuff. So a couple tips that were told to me. The first one is, I want to make sure everyone understands cash flow is different from revenue. Most businesses don't close or shut down due to revenue. They close down due to cash flow. And the fact of the matter is revenue obviously is money that you're going to be getting in, versus cash flow is actual money that's continuously funneling through to the business. So you have to make sure that a lot of times when you're going to get the money, it's always time that usually is your enemy. That's kind of really the big thing that, at least in my business, has always been the big issue. Now, a couple of things that I've done to kind of offside that, as some of the people here have mentioned, I make sure that there is an amount of money that's in the account that is the my biggest payment. So whatever my, I forget whatever is my biggest payment to whichever vendor it is, I make sure that that is always available in one of my accounts. So in case that something offset, like a tax bill, or somehow a payment came through that I didn't expect, or there was a mistake that was made, because sometimes vendors bill on accident and take into the cash reserves. Specifically, that it will help offset any recurring billing that you have. The other piece to that is what I've done is I actually have three different accounts. I have two checking accounts and I have a savings account. I have one checking account that all the receivables go in. So all money that I get paid goes into that account. And then my other account is where I pay all the bills. And the reason why I do that is because I'm very bad at keeping track of yearly or annual renewals. I'll have it notated in the calendar or something like that, but I'll just forget, or I'm expecting to pay another bill that's supposed to be coming out, and then this other bill comes through. And what I, the reason why I separate this out is because in the event that there, the amount of money is not in there, it just won't charge. And then I'll get notified and then I handle it accordingly. But that way it helps not take care of or take out money that, for example, rent for the office, you know, that's priority versus my RMM payment. You know, so that's how I kind of do all that, essentially, to prioritize what needs to be paid. And that helps me with the spending of the cash flow going out that way between my spending checking account versus the receivables that come in. Now, another piece to this is payments. Now, a lot of people will get either cash or checks. I personally do not take checks from residential clients unless they've been a client of mine for a long time and I trust them. The other piece to this is I don't take checks from businesses unless I've already done one job with them and they've paid either in cash, or which I never had been paid in cash by a business, or a credit card. I will not take a check first time around just because I want to develop that relationship with that business. Just because I've been burned so many times before when starting out, I just don't bother taking a check. Now, when you take a payment with a credit card, depending on your processor, it can take as long as 2 business days to get into your account. Now, 2 business days you may not think is a big deal, but when you get paid on a, let's say, a Thursday, you know, you don't get your money until Tuesday, you know, depending on your bank and processing and all that stuff. Well, vendors don't, will still charge you Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So, and Monday. So you still got 4 days that you got to make this payment. And then you got the bank fees if you haven't covered that payment. So what I've done is I've worked with my credit card processor and they offer next day funding. So with a relationship that I have with my CRM system, which is with Repair Shopper, I have Vantiv, and Vantiv actually does 2-day credit card processing as a regular, but through another fee that I pay, I think it's like $10 a month, I get it next day. And that $10 is worth it to me versus waiting 4 days and getting an actual fee that's $34 per transaction that got hit.
Okay.
So, you know, you might want to talk to your particular bank. You may want to talk to, depending on who your credit card processor is, if there is something of that sort, which next day funding, because next day funding work, it has dramatically helped with cash flow and has dramatically helped keep a lot of the fees and just making sure all the bills are paid on a timely basis.
Okay. Very good. And Mr. Chris Carruthers, what type of info do you have on your cash flow secrets?
Well, getting around to, you know, everything that's already been brought up. I have Net 30 with Tech Data. So what I'll wind up doing is if I have a project that involves purchasing new and I'm going through them, I'll always require payment up front. So that 3 business day for the credit card to go through doesn't really affect me because, you know, I have 30 days to pay the vendor anyway. if I'm doing a custom build system, then, you know, that tends to be a pretty expensive project. I'm usually billing at minimum $2,000 for a custom built system. So I require a full payment up front for things like that, because I'm going to be putting, you know, $1,300-$1,400 worth of parts into it. I'm going to make sure that I get that money up front. Same thing. I don't take checks from first time customers. I have made a couple of exceptions from, you know, referrals from very good clients. I make sure that everybody pays their invoices on time. I use late fees to really bring in the those payments. So, you know, people tend not to want to pay late fees. I know a lot of people also offer an early payment discount. So they'll figure out what they want to charge, and that's the early payment amount. So it looks better than a late fee, I guess. So that's it. You know, make sure your customers are paying their bills. Make sure you have good relationships set up with your vendors. If you're going to be buying something using a PayPal account, then maybe have that customer pay you by PayPal beforehand, so that you can just flow the money straight to Newegg or Amazon or whoever you're using. And I mean, that's it, really. Things can get very simple if you let it be simple. If you make sure that you have all of your processes lined up. If you know exactly how much of a markup you're going to put on everything, then it's very easy to make sure that you don't lose out on a job. You know, get those recurring revenues, right? Set up your online backup, set up your service plans, your antivirus, your Office 365. You know, there's a lot of different opportunities out there for even at $5, you know, a customer, if you wind up adding those up, you know, that winds up making $5 come in 5, 6, 7 times throughout the week. And it tends to make a difference over time. Separate accounts are important. You know, separating your regular checking account from the account that you keep your income tax, sales tax, WSIB, if you're dealing with that, employee taxes and healthcare spending, you know, any of those fixed amount billings that you know you're going to have to pay should be going into a separate account, so that you know that either every week, every 2 weeks, or every month, you have to put X amount of dollars into that account to make sure that that's being kept. And don't overload yourself with inventory. I'm in a bit of a different situation than some people, but the only real inventory I keep anymore are hard drives. I have a shelf full of hard drives sitting over here because I use those on a regular basis. But anything else, you know, I'm going to wind up ordering as I go. And the last thing that I do is I make sure that I charge everybody a $40 diagnostic fee before I even touch anything. So, you know, $40 doesn't sound like a lot, but if I have four computers come in like that and three of them go back, that's $120 that I have to go into my cash flow for ordering parts for other jobs.
Very good.
Yeah, and Chris actually makes a good point. When I first started out, I was using PayPal's credit card receipt, PayPal here. And I was using their credit card readers to run credit cards on site, especially for those that needed a part when I was on site to go get, and I didn't have the cash flow at the time. So when I first started out, basically I would swipe the card. It would take out the 2.75%. I worked that in as my invoice, whatever it was. I'd swipe it. It'd be available right away in my PayPal balance. I had my PayPal MasterCard debit card. I'd go run to the place. I'd get the part, come back, take care of it, charge the remainder of the thing, gave them their receipt as a full invoice, and called it a day.
Nice. Very good.
So the main reason of all this is basically to know where your money goes, create excess cash, and then to use your cash flows as an indicator, I think is what we've all said, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that, and I encourage all people, especially when you're starting out or for people who've been in business for a while, but maybe they are used to, we are in a society that is used to a payment mentality. And what I mean by that is we go to the car dealership and we go, what's my monthly payment? We go to, you know, whatever. We go to buy something. Hey, what's going to be my monthly payment on that furniture, appliances, whatever it is. That's the mentality we're in. When you're running your own business, you want to have, I think Paco alluded to it, the term is runway, right? You want to have X amount of months of cash that you can basically move to paying those bills that pop up out of nowhere and your regular expenses. So you're not robbing Peter to pay Paul, because that's what we're used to doing. And the other thing to caution everybody out there is that if you see the next new shiny object and you go, that's going to make me more efficient, and I'm going to spend the money on that, and it's going to make me a better technician, don't do it. What you need to do is you need to have whatever your amount of cash flow that you need to have in place for emergencies and other things and regular bills on a monthly basis. You need to have that. And then when you've got extra outside of that and you go, hey, I'm going to get this tool that's going to help me in my business. And then you've got that extra cash flow to be able to do what you want to do. And you're not pulling from one account to put into another account and moving it from this point to that point, because that in itself not only will get very old, it shuts a lot of businesses down.
Keep in mind too, I mean, you know, we slap the wrists of a lot of our customers when they try to do their own IT. You know, if you find that you're getting lost and you don't understand what cash flow is, like really and truly, not that you don't understand the definition of it, but if you can take out a financial statement out of whatever invoicing system you're using, or if you're using QuickBooks, if you run those reports and you look at them and you really and truly don't understand what you're looking for, that is what a bookkeeper and an accountant are for. Right. So, you know, don't be afraid to outsource that. I know it is an expense, but it's well worth it. If you don't understand your financial statement, they'll be able to explain it to you to a point where they can say, listen, this is what you look like. This is how we're going to keep you operational. This is how we're going to keep you making money. And if you want to make a big purchase, they can tell you whether you can afford to make that purchase or if you're going to have to wait until you get to a certain point with your cash flow.
That's good.
So hire somebody for that.
Yeah.
And I agree with Chris, but I would change that into, instead of, sorry, John, I would change that out from expense to investment, because essentially you're in an investment, you're basically going to be making money. And when you go through a bookkeeper, perfect example, with the help of my bookkeeper and Jeff, when I first started out, my expenses were $1,500. I was literally, as a part-time tech at the time, was making $1,500. So I was breaking literally even or a little bit over. What did I say, Jeff instead of John? But essentially, what was happening is that I was all into so many of the shiny things, the new RMMs, the new websites, the white label remote services, and you know, so forth and so on, that I was at to the point where there was a lot of stuff that I needed to do on my own. And I needed to go ahead and dial back on really what does my customer want. And what I was doing was investing in tools that I was hoping the customers would go for versus investing in tools for what I need. And it's going to help me get better at what's going on. So essentially what was going on is that I was getting the RMMs. I was getting all the new systems and things like that. But at the time, I didn't need it. And now as I slowly grew, I started adding these components and really getting points. So now I was actually from that conversation, lowered the amount of locations I had, lowered the tools or find different type of services to control my costs, but really get me able to control what I needed as far as cost. And my costs are at a point now where I think my monthly cost now is about $850. Compared to the close to 1500 to 2000 that I had when I was a part-time tech. And now that I'm full-time, I'm making even more money and keeping that cost at a low. And when I get to the point that it's really bad, I can either outsource it or add more tools to help me make more money as it goes along. And I wouldn't have been able to do that outside of a community of good friends and being able to have specifically, like Chris said, a bookkeeper / an accountant to guide you on what you need to do with your cash flow.
All right. That's good. Hey, we got a question from the chat room, and this is from our own Marvin B. We haven't seen on a show in a while. Just email me, Marvin. Anyways, he's asking,
we miss
anyone you. Get a line of credit, and how do you go about doing that? And I'll tell you from my standpoint as a part-time tech, what I did was back in the day, I basically got a PayPal credit account. And it used to be called something else. I can't remember what it was, but back way, 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 a long time ago. What was that?
Bill me later.
Bill me later. Thank you. So I got one of those and that's great. It's not good if you're going to not pay the thing off on a regular basis though, because the percentage rate is astronomical. I think it's well over 20 some odd percent.
Yeah, I've used that too.
So,
and it is high.
It is very high, but it's convenient because there's a couple things that PayPal does in the basically PayPal credit now, or what used to be called Bill Me Later, is that you can, a lot of things, if you're spending over, I think it's over $100 in most cases, you can get 6 months, no interest. A lot of times, no interest, no payment. I don't recommend doing that. But for the a lot of things that you're able to order online, that is a quick, easy way to do. The only thing that you can't use PayPal for or PayPal credit is for something like Amazon. Now, most other services that I've gotten parts from, you can use PayPal. But Amazon, obviously, you've got to either use your own money, which is what I do, or use another form of credit card or line of credit.
So I will add on to this as well. What I had to do, and this is for those of the technicians. See, I'm going to talk about the things that a lot of techs and business owners don't want to talk about. My personal business credit was crap. It was complete shot. It was, I mean, there was a lot of bad decisions made personally about myself and just other people involved with my credit that caused me to not be able to get any type of personal credit. Getting into bad car loans, things like that, along with not being able to get any type of business credit because they need that personal guarantor to guarantee the business credit. Now, what I did was to slowly build that business credit was I started opening up Net30 accounts. Well, first thing I did was I opened up an account with nav.com, and it used to be called Creditera. Essentially, for those who have used Credit Karma for personal credit, nav.com handles both personal and business credit. And what I did was I used their service and them with the resources that they had in there helped me understand there are different types of tiers to get business credit. And level one business credit is Net30 accounts. And there are different companies that everyone can apply to that will get a Net30 account, no matter what your credit is. And what I did was open up two or three of those, which was a Quill.com account. The other one was a Grainger account and Uline. And I opened up Net30 accounts. I bought and each one has their own predicaments or qualifications to get on your business credit. Because what a lot of people don't understand is that business credit is different than personal credit. The vendors will report to your personal credit. Business credit, you have to ask your vendors to report to your credit. See, and there are letters that you would send to your vendors. And if your vendors already report to your business credit or in their different credit unions, which is, or credit bureaus, which is D&H or Duns & Bradstreet, which is D&B, Experian Business and Equifax Business are three of the ones that are for business credit. And what if they have a relationship with them, each one has their own qualifications or criteria on how they report to these particular bureaus. So it's a lot more details into it. You can find all that information on NAV, and you can also find out with that particular vendor. But the point of all this is that once you've cleared that tier one and build a good relationship and notify these bureaus that you're working with them on your Net30, staying consistent on a particular amount of money that you're spending with them, you then go to your second level, which is a gas credit card, a store credit card from like Staples or from anyone like that. And then once you start going from there, you go to your third line, which allows you for commercial financing. So a lot of these are learning experiences. And for those that just don't have the credit because of these type of things, these are some of the steps you have to take to be able to even qualify to get a line of credit if that's something you're trying to do to offset and help with the cash flow in your business.
And the one thing I will say to that, and that's a very good explanation, Paco, is that my recommendation, and somebody was mentioning in the chat, JD Venice in the chat room says Amazon does have credit as well. And that is true. What I have tried to do over the years, because back in the day, I had more credit cards coming out of my wallet than I care to even imagine. And so what I tried to do is I tried to simplify everything. Is a line of credit a bad thing? Not necessarily, but you have to know how much control over your own self you're going to have and how disciplined you're going to be. So for a lot of people out there, I would say if you can avoid doing that for the big part of it, I probably would. And that's why I only use the PayPal credit now, just because of the couple benefits and everything else I keep in my business account, and I just buy it out of there. So it's not a big deal. I've got basically a debit card. I can go to Micro Center or wherever I'm going, or Best Buy if I need to buy something on the spot, or my local computer repair competitor, which I've done on occasion. So for that stuff, it's not a big deal. But I would suggest that you go out there and you basically do the jobs that you can do that are basically service type jobs that are going to get you that revenue and just start putting it away and start accumulating. It accumulates quick. Yes, in the beginning, you've got to sit there and you've got to pound the street pavement, right? And go out there and get the jobs. But there's a plenty of stuff that you can do out there. And then you can transition into businesses and different things you want to do, where, again, even for businesses, small businesses, medium, doesn't matter, I am still going to require them to pay for the hardware up front. So there, in my opinion, there is no quick process to this. Yes, as soon as I get a payment and it clears, I can order the stuff. Like Brad said earlier, if you trust the customer, you could, if you've got enough cash on hand, you can go ahead and order that stuff ahead of time. But I would try to, for the most part, stay away from having all these different lines of credit. And if you're going to have one that's going to make sense for doing most of the business that you do. And like I said, back in the day, PayPal credit was one of them.
Going to add a part two to this. Thanks to Marvin again in the chat. Anyone getting business credit cards to keep business money separate from your personal money? And that winds up becoming a very interesting question depending on the country or state that you're in and the type of banking that you can handle. So as a very good example, up here in Canada, if your business doesn't have certain markers that the bank wants, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to get a credit card. And I wind up running into an issue where I had a separate credit card. Unfortunately, the only way to pay them was to send the payment through online banking, which took 10 business days for the money to show up on there. So if you think waiting 3 days for money to show up in your bank account is bad enough, try taking those 3 days and then waiting another 10 business days for the money to show up on the credit card to pay the bill.
You live in Canada or something?
Right? It's almost like we're in the shitty state.
So the other thing you might want to look at that JD kind of brought up, which made me think, is if you purchase a lot of stuff from Amazon, you know, they have that new Amazon credit card where you get 5% back. So if you'd buy a ton, 5% is a nice little chunk if you're buying direct from them. But
in the US. So do you have any idea how many things you guys have talked about that we can't do up here? The PayPal credit isn't available up here. You can't get a PayPal card up here. You can't get the Amazon cards up here. You know, we're stuck in this little situation where we have to go to our bank and say, can I have a credit card, please? And they say, no.
Do they have programs like
what Marvin says about business credit cards? I don't carry a business credit card, but I have a separate credit card that I only put business expenses on.
Right.
So
another thing too that you can do as far as, and I'm not sure if it's available in Canada, is there's two things. One, you could do some type of secured payments is what they're called. So secured credit card or secured accounts. I did was with I forgot which bank it was at the time, but essentially they had, you know, give us X amount of money. You know, yeah, you're paying interest on your own money, but after X amount of time, we'll give you your money back. And then it's an unsecured credit card. We know you're good. So that's one way of being able to get a credit card on your own if your credit sucks and you can't apply for a credit card or get approved for one. The other piece to it is getting a trade account from, like, for example, Micro Center. Same thing that I did with that, or, you know, a Fry's, Newegg. Not sure how their programs work. Where Micro Center, they specifically denied me for an unsecured credit account. But if I gave them a check for X amount of money, they would open up that credit line for me X amount of time. Essentially, they'll go ahead and put the money back into my account, but I'll be able to use that as a default account. And especially during tax time, for those that don't have the right credit and are looking to make something a little bit more official versus not keeping a personal card for separate business expenses. If, again, it's all a choice, right? Because you're all going to manage your money the same way. You're going to keep track of all your expenses, write out your expense reports, so you can give it to your business. But essentially, these are going to be two options where if you did some type of cash up front with these businesses, they may be able to allow you to get some type of credit account. But as Jeff mentioned, and I forgot to mention this before, with any credit line such as Cabbage, with OnDeck or anybody like that, you got to use it in moderation, because the moment, a lot of people always believe that lack of funds and lack of money is the problem of their business. And I've learned that that is not the case, because you can have all the money in the world and it still won't get you where you need to be if you don't have a solid plan or a strategic way of being able to take advantage of the funds when you have it.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking from experience, if you're borrowing, if you're using credit to, because you have to, it's going to get you into trouble. If you're doing it to, as a part of managing your cash flow and some kind of an accounting strategy, then that's fine. But yeah, using credit just to kind of float your business because you're broke, Yeah. It's just going to make you more broke.
That's right. I mean, really, you know, really good rule here. If you're using credit, it should be so that you can manage it, not so that you can keep your business going. I mean, at the end of the day, if you can't pay off your line of credit or credit cards or whatever it is that you're doing at the end of the month, then you're doing it wrong.
Wow. That's usually my line. That's good, Chris. No, and the other thing too is that, and I think I did mention this, but if you get a business account, a business checking account, they will give you a debit card, which acts just like a credit card. The difference being you have to have money in your account to use it. So if you need to order things online or anything like that, you've got to have that money available. And that's what I would recommend. And that keeps it separate from your personal account where you're not going to whatever store or ordering online with your own personal checking account and doing it that way. So
unless you're in Canada,
I'm sorry, Chris, listen, for all the, you know, for the handful of listeners from Canada that are listening, I apologize.
Hey, I don't point it out, then they're going to go running to their bank asking for these magic things that they're not gonna
have. That don't exist. Right.
Yeah.
It's a unicorn. I seen one. Honest. All right. So, is any other last thoughts before we move on here that anybody has as far as cash flow tips or anything we haven't talked about yet?
I think we've touched on, but just to kind of lay it out there, people will spend what they have. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's just it's what people tend to do. So if you have to come up with a trick or something to make you start putting cash away and working with less on your daily expenses, then maybe like, personally, because I've been growing as a person managing money myself, and I didn't learn good habits as a child growing up. So I started using this cool it's a new app called Stash, and you can just set it up, and it's like an investment account. But I mostly just use it because it makes me put every time I get personal monies, I take 10% and I just throw it in there because it's hard to get back. I mean, it's easy. It just takes a few business days, but you know, but it's like, I can't just go get it. If I was putting money in the mattress, I could just go get that. Right. And I can go spend it. This is like, it's going into an investment account. It's mentally difficult for me to get it back out of it. And
it helps you with your discipline.
A trick that I'm using to make myself act like an adult. So,
yeah, I'm on the same page because if I don't, it's out of sight, out of mind. So yep. If I don't see it and it's hard for me and a pain in the butt to grab it, I won't do it. I do the same thing with a Capital One account, and I shred that debit card. So essentially, if I need it, I will have to put it to a credit card. It'll have to clear that payment, and then I will take it out from there. So
I got one for John. John, what recommendations do you have for a cash reserve?
2 minutes, 2 months of monthly expenses.
I think that's a pretty good. I think if you're looking at starting your business, 6 months. Myself, as an ongoing thing, yeah, I think that 2 months is good.
Well, 6 months, that would be survival money, meaning, in my opinion, of your personal expenses as well.
Yeah. Sorry, I thought that's what the question and answer was, is both. Just talking business, 2 months is enough. If you can't keep your cash flow going with 2 months worth of money, then yeah, there's something that needs to be looked at.
Yep.
The other thing that I think people need to consider, especially if you're a solo tech or you don't have any other people to help you generate income, is you should be looking at some AFLAC or something, some way, you know, if you are a solo tech and you depend on the income from your business to support your family and the rest of your lifestyle, you need some sort of insurance to make sure that if you get disabled, so disability insurance is what I'm talking about, that if you get disabled for some sort of period of time, that you are protected personally.
Yeah,
or have some sort of income personally, and that's not very expensive.
No, and yeah, you can get that for yourself personally, and you'll get a percentage of whatever you would have normally brought in. They'll look at your tax returns for that. You can get the exact same thing for your business, and it is called a direct Oh, no. Director something something insurance. Ask your insurance broker about director's insurance. Because you know, if you're a solo tech, you are the director of your company. That insurance will protect the income of the company. So if you wind up getting sick or getting hit by a bus, or you can't work for an extended period of time, that insurance will pay out to the company so that the company expenses can be kept up so that you still have a business when you come back.
Okay, good. All right, so let's see. I think let's go ahead and we're going to move on into our email and take some calls. Before we do that, I just want to, we're going to take a quick break. If this show has impacted you in any way, then I would encourage you to go to patreon.com/computer repair podcast. And I want to take this a moment to thank all of our Patreon supporters for their continued support. You guys are keeping the show afloat because everything costs money. And it's nice to have that cash flow to basically take care of the little incidental expenses that we do have. All right, so let's answer some emails and take some calls. Phone lines are open. The call-in number is 1-888-697-0162. All right, it's this one is, says, this is from Robert. And this says, hello, Jeff and all. I would like to know if any of you have heard of The Cure. Yes, that's what that's what it is with a K. K-U-R-E. Go to thecure.com. Website for more information on it. From the website, it says antivirus software just doesn't work anymore. It worked 20 years ago, but the hackers had just gotten too smart. The Cure is not an antivirus software. With The Cure, you will never need any antivirus software again. The Cure builds a safe house or a vault on your hard drive away from your operating system and data. Inside that vault, you can open up as many viruses as you want. Then simply shut the computer off, turn it back on again. The viruses are destroyed and your computer is back in pristine condition. Price is a lifetime license for one PC, no annual fees. Compatible with Windows 10, 8, 7, and Vista. If you ever get a virus that can't be removed, we will replace your computer with one of equal value up to $1,000.
I'm gonna, no.
That sounds like kiosk mode.
No, first off, if you want to do an ad on the show, you should really buy some. Jeff. Jeez. All right.
Go ahead.
So,
not to mention this site. I mean, my website isn't the world's greatest website, I admit. But
this is.
I'm a computer pro. I mean, that coffee pot is hot.
That's I mean, crazy. Hot
coffee. Wow, that's a lot. I mean, yeah, Marvin's is a lot better than this.
Wow.
I mean, Marvin's old site, not his new site.
Look, I'm just saying here that you know, there's a lot of different companies like this. I think that the website here is selling me. There's no way. There's absolutely no way that they can legitimately make a claim of anything that they're saying on this website. I guarantee you that there's some clause in there somewhere that they're going to use to not replace that computer. And I bet you that this is just one guy sitting in his basement writing code. I mean, there's no way. There's no way. Who said,
yeah, okay. But LPGA golf professional and three-time major champion Jan Stevenson says you need to protect your data.
Celebrities can be paid to endorse whatever they want.
I mean, but if a golf champion says it's good.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to trust a golf champion about their computer.
Wow.
That is a good-looking trophy. No.
Now, I will tell you that I've ran into computers before, and people have been doing this forever, for a very long time. One of the things that people have done, and these are computer repair shops that do this, they will set it up on a Windows machine where you basically have an image of whatever the machine is at a certain state. And when you shut the computer off and you turn it back on, it is back in that state again. What they'll do is they'll take and partition the hard drive so that you can keep downloaded data and different things like that on that secondary hard drive. But every time you restart the computer, it goes back to that initial image where it's basically a clean image, brand new install, whatever you want to call it. And I've seen that several times from several different companies.
Sure, but that's not an antivirus, though. That's just wiping your computer every time you restart it.
Correct. But it is a way of doing something that can hopefully protect you. So some people have been fine with a operating system that works like that because they get on the internet, they're in the browser, and they're done and gone. And every time they start it up, it works identically the same way it did last time.
Used by the U.S. military, whatever.
I mean, that's essentially what you do with a hotel lobby computer or any, you know, publicly accessible computer. They generally have some kind of imaging refresh. XP used to have Microsoft used to have that as a feature that you could download for free. And then they stopped doing it. But.
Right. Yep. Yeah, there's been different pieces of software that have done this in the past. So in my opinion, this is nothing new. It's been around for a while. It just depends on whether that's how you want to set it up for your customer and whether they're happy with how that works, basically resetting itself every time. So I'm not sure exactly how this software works, but it sounds similar.
I mean, it's just another tool. So if it does, let's say it does, and let's say it's awesome. I mean, that might not be something you want on every PC, but that it might be a solution, just like Bradford said, on a kiosk computer or a school computer or something, I guess.
But I mean, even those programs like Deep Freeze, and actually that's the only one that's coming to mind right now for some reason, they're not invulnerable either. You know, the base image that you created can easily become corrupted on these things. So are they going to replace my entire computer if I get a virus and after I restart it, the image is corrupt?
Well, and that's a good point, Chris. I mean, yes, we know that a lot of times, you know, even the Windows environment, when it creates an image, a lot of times those end up being corrupt. They don't actually work when you actually need them. So that's why we often recommend third-party pieces of software. Who knows? There's a lot of guesswork that goes into that. So
I tell you what, they're located in Tampa, Florida. We'll have B drive over and check them out.
There you go.
There you go. That's a good idea. And we'll find out.
Let us know.
Marvin, while you're there, can you find out how much it costs them to get themselves as a question on Jeopardy?
That's funny. All right. So let's see. This is from Jonathan. It says, I have a Windows 10 tablet that's dirt cheap. After owning it for almost 2 years, the drive has become full. The only problem is I'm running little to no programs, and any programs I have are not big. When I look in the settings, most of the space is in the stuff that helps run the system, and a very large chunk of it was the past program, which was Windows 8.1. But I can't delete the past program because of how out of date the tablet is, that I run the risk of crashing the system and destroying it. I even put an SD card in the tablet, but the system won't let me save new files. And the stuff that is on the largest app, OneDrive, to the SD card, what should I do? So my response, and you guys can tell me what you think. My response was, I hate to have to tell you this, but you're probably going to have to do a fresh install of Windows 10 on that particular tablet and basically wipe everything out, because something, either the old files from Windows 8.1 are taking up a lot of room. And a lot of times when your disk is almost full, you won't be able to sync or anything with OneDrive or any of these other programs out there. It causes conflicts and problems because you have to have enough space on the hard drive for files to be able to move around when you're starting them. So what do you guys think?
Computer Pro thinks we should just run the cure. I don't see why you couldn't delete the windows.old folder though.
Okay.
I mean, they're really the only reason why that's there is so that you can revert it, but there's no way that it was updated so short of a time ago that that's even going to need to be there anymore.
I have ran into problems where the windows.old folder, even after 30 days, still can't get rid of it.
It won't delete even through third party software.
Nope.
Okay.
Don't know why, so
I'll believe you. I haven't seen it myself. Okay. So I don't have anything that I can add to that.
And tablets can kind of be funny too, right? I mean, really.
Lean into it, just a fresh install. At some point, you've just got so much stuff.
Yep.
You could try TreeSize free, which is a neat, I use that program a lot to scans the drive and it gives you a sorted by aisle size.
Okay.
It starts, you know, so you can tackle the stuff that's the folders that are the largest first.
Got it.
Usually you'll find that in your Windows folder that the, I can't remember the name of the folder, but it's the one that contains all the updates and stuff that have accumulated over time is the biggest.
Yep.
Or one of the biggest.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you could do, but I think once you start getting that thing so full and it's already made some corruptions in the system, basically the best thing is going to be a fresh install.
Yeah.
And I probably would fresh install it with Windows 10.
Boy, yeah, just saying get a new tablet.
Well, that too. You could do that too, but it's 2 years old. Or if you're worried about
space, don't have a tablet. But I mean, what are you going to have on there, right? You're going to have maybe some pictures because it's a tablet. Sounds like OneDrive is the biggest thing that's being used. So anything that's in OneDrive is just going to resync.
Or get the stuff out of OneDrive. That's another, and maybe then you can basically start getting rid of some of the files and figuring out what's going on there. If you basically, or turn OneDrive off and get rid of all the stuff out of the OneDrive folder on that particular computer, it'll still be in the cloud, correct?
As long as you turn off the sync first, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I would probably back it up onto an external drive of some sort.
With the multiple USB ports you have on the tablets?
Well, yeah, that's a good question.
You're looking at a cloud backup, honestly. If you need to back it up, use a cloud backup, because chances are, unless you have a dock or something already, you're not going to have the USB port to connect the external, and an SD card is probably not going to be able to hold enough.
Right. There is a part 2 to this email, so we'll move on with that. And basically, this is from Jonathan again. He says, I am 15 and want to get into computer programming and repair. Do you know of any free programs or classes to take to learn? Right now, YouTube is the only website that I'm learning from. I am starting to migrate to podcasts and ebooks, but want one solid place to learn from. Anyone?
A visual learner, you could check out that, what is it, IT Pro TV?
Yep.
Well, and the only caveat to that is that, yeah, you could try it out for free. What, I think they give a 30-day trial, right?
Yeah.
He can also try Cybrary. We had it on the show before on Computer Business Podcast. It's CYBRARY.IT. It's free training on cybersecurity and a bunch of other courses that they got on there.
Okay.
Got now, that. If you're 15, you're probably still in high school. So here's the question to the Americans on that show. Do you guys have cooperative education programs in your high schools?
Okay. I mean, what is it?
Huh?
Okay.
Say who?
Mentorship kind of things?
So the cooperative education program is something that at least we have here, where it's a high school class that you take where they send you to a job site and you actually you're trained on site doing the job. So we actually had when I had the store, we had a co-op student come in from the high school, and he did repairs with my technician. We didn't have to pay him anything because he wasn't an employee. We also didn't, you know, give him any work to do on his own. But he got to
here
learn.
In America, we call that internship.
Okay. Nope. That's a whole.
I'm just kidding.
We do, but it's selective. What we call electives. So essentially, if it's outside of the normal criteria of a particular program, at least for Chicago Public Schools, it's an elective, and it's only X amount of so many people that can get in. So there's a chance he could, depending on where he is and whatever, if he is in private or public education. I know that that's normally an elective that has to be selected through a vetting process. So
see, that's,
I know a
crazy
lot of the high schools around here, you can get your, well, back in the day, I would call it your CNA, or you could get some Microsoft certs by taking some of the computer classes already. So you could come out of high school and have a CNA, Cisco Network Engineer or Administrator, out of high school.
And there are some tech schools that are attached to, like in the junior high school range, that you can become a part of, that I think are provided. I know we had one in our local area. And if you were going to junior high, went and took some audio visual classes over there, and taught me how to do things with cameras and video cameras and whatnot, and made some short films and different things. got my taste with that. And, you know, now I'm doing YouTube videos, you know, who knew? But there are things out there that you can grab a hold of right in your own community. The problem is, I don't know if you're going to get everything all in one spot. And that's the biggest issue. I think a lot of times if you get from different resources, you can kind of pick and choose what you want from those different resources and figure out what's going to work best for you. And that's just my opinion on that. All right. So Brad, thank you for this subject for today. If people wanted to get a hold of you, where would they do that?
You can see me go to my website at ttcscomputerservices.com. You can find me on Google Plus, Brad at ttcscomputerservices.com.
Very good. And Mr. Chris Carruthers, where can people find out more about what you're up to?
Well, you can find out more about our white label IT services by going to our website, rstechteam.com. You can email us at info@rstechteam.com, or you can give us a call at 866-568-2813. And I am currently deciding whether I'm going to auction off that person's phone number or not.
All right. And Mr. John Dubinsky, where can people find out more about you?
Mavengroup.net. But more importantly, our friend from the Deep South, Marvin B., is going to join us in the Great White North. So it's a little Podnuts mini meetup in Chicago. So this, Jeff, you always post these really quick. So everybody will get this information on March 18th in Chicago. I'm going to be there. Marvin's going to be there. I think Paco's coming in, Tom Wilmot. So there'll be a bunch of us. We're all going to meet at the Chicago Hilton. I'll put the link in the show notes, 4 p.m. We'll meet at the main lobby. So if you're in the area or can join us, we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Sounds good. All right. And Mr. Paco LeBron, where are you and what are you up to? Where are you? What are you up to? Where can people find you at, man?
So currently you can find me here on the Computer Repair Live show every other week. And as everyone heard from our last episode, the Computer Business Podcast is no more. So we have went on a hiatus. We will be returning with a new show that has been yet to be titled and yet to debut on a schedule. So I will keep everyone appraised of that.
All right. Very good. Sounds like fun. All right. So let's see. You guys can come join us for the live show, the Computer Repair Podcast, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern over at podnets.com/Computer Repair Podcast Live. Join in on the conversation by calling in live and hanging out in the chat room. We have audio available over at podnets.com or subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. You can be notified when the show is live by subscribing to our YouTube channel, Computer Repair Podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnets, the Computer Repair Podcast.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.